This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. In the United States, presidents have become synonymous with money, maybe because they appear on it. Lincoln on the penny, for now at least, George Washington on the dollar bill, Andrew Jackson on the 20. While our presidents are literally on our money and their decisions affect our financial lives, we often know a lot less about their financial lives. In 2016, Donald Trump, who has filed for bankruptcy 6 times, ran on the businessman persona marketed on The Apprentice, an NBC reality TV show. Here he is way back in season 1, giving a tour of his apartment to contestants.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
So look, if you're really successful, you'll all live just like this.
We can only wish.
Maybe never.
Maybe not.
Or maybe even better. But if you're really successful, I mean, this is what it is, and it's fun. I show this apartment to very few people, presidents, kings. Let me give you a little tour.
Okay.
All right, on today's show, we're going to talk about the relationship between money and the American presidency. Earlier this week, I spoke with Megan Gorman. She's the founding partner of Checkers Financial Management and the author of the book, All the President's Money, How the Men Who Governed America Governed Their Money. Megan, welcome to the 21st Show.
Oh, Brian, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And again, Megan and I spoke Monday afternoon, in case news intervenes. Because of that, we're not taking calls live as well, but you can always let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. All right, you are the founder and managing partner of a financial company. You probably could have written a lot of different books about finance. Why focus on the finances of the U.S. presidents?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, but I think it goes back to what I've always loved since I was 6 years old, which is studying the presidents. And I'm from a very small town in southern New Jersey. And so when you're young, reading about the presidents, what you realize is a lot of our presidents are from small towns and leave them to go on a hero's journey. So I think as a kid, I always related to the presidents. And then as I got into my career as an adult, I was very fortunate. You know, I was a tax attorney, but I worked at a division of Goldman Sachs. And I got to work with very wealthy individuals and families and got a very front row seat on how you build wealth in this country. And a lot of it was eye-opening to me. I grew up middle class. And so as I started to think about the skills I saw my clients have, the ability to manage risk, the ability to budget, who they married, I got curious. Well, which of our presidents did a good job with their money and which didn't? And we have this general idea that they all become crazy wealthy from the presidency. But the truth is a little bit different than that. And I think as a result, what the presidents and their personal finance show us is exactly how hard it is to build wealth in this country.
I like how you put who they married in there with a list of like attributes like managing risk, but I guess it takes a little bit of the romance out, but it really is the story of money in America, isn't it? In a lot of ways.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, well, let's start. Well, let's on that point, maybe. Let's start with the finances of our first president, George Washington. What is his financial picture? How did the way he handled finances set a precedent?
Well, it's interesting because George Washington, we always think of the older version of Washington, the very stoic guy that's on the dollar bill. But George Washington, as a young man, he was ambitious, he was gritty, he was really focused on building wealth. And the reason was, even though he grew up in Virginia on a plantation, his father died when Washington was 14 or 15 years old and left everything to his son Lawrence from his first marriage. And so poor George grows up not even getting in his father's estate plan money for a college education. And so George Washington embarks on learning how to build wealth because of his neighbors, a family by the last name of Fairfax. Now, we all know Fairfax, Virginia today, but the Fairfaxes were very wealthy, and they're the ones who sort of mentored George Washington and taught him how to survey. And this was important because this was a period of time when land was very, you know, acquisition of land was accessible if you could generate the capital to do so. And that's one of the things that Washington did, is as he learned to survey and make money, he started to buy land. And this would culminate by the end of his life to over 52,000 acres from Virginia all the way up to New York and Ohio. But Washington was a pretty clever guy, and there were some skills that Washington had that are pretty valuable to us even today. The first is he was an amazing budgeter. I mean, if you get a chance to ever look up George Washington's budgets at the Library of Congress, they're stunning. And so Washington was always very good at keeping track of money. And I'll give you a quick story about this. Washington, when he was asked to be the commander of the Revolutionary Army, he said to Congress, "I'll take the job, but I'm not going to take a salary." Right? Now, at this point, he had built up a lot of wealth, and I'll explain why in a moment. But he did say to Congress, "Look, you have to pay my expenses." And so Congress thought, well, that's a screaming deal. And off George Washington went. And unbeknownst to all of them, it would be an 8-year battle. And at the end of the 8-year battle, Washington submits to Congress's expenses. And with this very impeccable budgeting, Congress is floored to see that Washington's expenses were $163,000 and that he had every detail, every receipt, everything calculated to a T. And so they had to pay him that. And this is one of the things about Washington. He realized that budgeting and being responsible about money only enhanced his reputation. But I'll tell you one funny thing about Washington, because other presidents down the line do the th same thing. When Washington was coming up and learning how to buy land and surveying and working for the king's surveying in certain towns, he started to acquire enough money that he was known as a catch. And in his time period, you have to remember he was 6'2". And this was a time when most men were 5'6", 5'7". So he was gorgeous. And there was a very wealthy widow by the name of Martha Custis who became available when her husband died. And Washington and Martha meet, and Washington's a great dancer, and they fall in love and marry. And Washington sets the precedent for a lot of presidents because he marries up. Martha's much more wealthier than he is. And so, as a result, by that marriage, he becomes one of the wealthiest men in the colonies.
I love it. I also love that detail that he submitted his expenses at the end of the war. Next time I get grief from HR for taking a little too long to submit my expense reports, I'm going to say, well, could have been 8 years. Let's talk
Exactly.
more
Or you could
about.
have been James Monroe, who never submitted his expenses for, all the work he did over the years and then tried to submit them at the end of his life, and Congress sort of laughed at him. And Monroe ends up pretty much broke living with his daughter in New York. So it can happen.
Yeah. All right. Let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. This is the 21st show. We are talking about the presidents and their money with Megan Gorman. She's the founding partner of Checkers Financial Management and the author of the book, All the President's Money: How the Men Who Governed America Governed Their Money. We're going to take a break on the show. When we come back, we'll have more. This is the 21st show. Stay with us. This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking with Megan Gorman. She's the founding partner of Checkers Financial Management and also an author of the book, All the President's Money: How the Men Who Governed America Governed Their Money. We taped this conversation on Monday of this week, so no calls today, but let us know what you thought. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. All right, Megan, before the break, we were talking about George Washington, and especially Martha Washington. Talk more about the role of marriage and the women in the lives of American presidents have had over time.
Yeah, I mean, who you marry is incredibly important if you're going to be financially successful. And that might seem like an odd thing to say, but marriage is really an exchange of values. Right. And you need to be in alignment in order to succeed with your mutual finances. Now, the ones who do it well make it look incredibly easy. You know, we have presidents like Lyndon Johnson and Lady Bird. You know, they were very clear in what their goals were financially. And Lady Bird herself was incredibly savvy with money. You know, she grew up when she was four, she lost her mother. And she inherited money from her mother, but her father and her uncle taught her a lot about money. And so one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, when she comes to meet Lyndon Johnson, he's not a wealthy guy. You know, Lyndon marries up a lot, like Washington did. But Lady Bird always tempered him. And Lady Bird always had her own business, because with her separate property, she bought a radio station in Austin. Doesn't mean Lyndon Johnson didn't help her with it or have influence, but it was a really good dance that the two of them did, and they were very in line with their finances. And so you see that again and again. Another quick president to talk about with marriage is Ronald Reagan. You know, Ronald Reagan grew up poor, you know, really learned to budget as a way of managing stress, and he gets to Hollywood and he falls in love with an actress by the name of Jane Wyman. And she also had grown up poor, right? You would think, oh, that's similar values. But Jane was a spender, and Ronald Reagan was very, very frugal and very strict on budgeting. And so they would butt heads. And you would see in the Hollywood magazines, Jane would talk about this, that Ronnie doesn't like bills. Ronnie has a phobia about debt. And they would fight about it. And of course, this ends up being one of the things that undermines their marriage. Lucky for Ronald Reagan, Nancy Reagan was far more interested in budgeting and sort of being on the same page as him. And obviously they had tremendous financial success. So it's really, really important. And of course, you know, this is Illinois Public Radio. So I have to mention Abraham Lincoln.
Because you anticipated my next question. So let's go there.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you think about Lincoln, right, he was an incredibly smart man, but the Lincolns as a marriage was one that was incredibly mismatched financially. You know, they had stuff in common like politics, but Lincoln grew up poor, Mary grew up wealthy in Lexington, Kentucky. And when they get married, you know, she moves into his world. And so she goes from these salons and beautiful places in Springfield, Illinois, to a boarding house. And she doesn't really realize his financial situation until after they're married. And so what this does is it starts off a chain of events with the Lincolns, where Abraham Lincoln worked very hard at saving, creating stability. And Mary, at the same time, was a spender, right? She would go out and she'd buy clothing, she'd buy bolts of cloth, but she'd buy so much of it so that no other woman in town could have the same dress as her. And this just keeps getting amplified, Brian, until they're in the White House. And the salary at the time Lincoln was in the White House was $25,000 a year. It's a lot of money for 1861. And so he's saving the bulk of his salary into treasury bonds that paid 6 or 7%. Mary's off in New York spending. She's buying gloves. She's buying plates. She's buying furs. When she's at the White House, she's overbilling the U.S. government for state dinners. And she gets to the point with her in debt that she says to her dressmaker, during Lincoln's reelection, I really need him to win, because if he doesn't win, he's going to find out about our debt. And so this was one of these things that just shows how mismatched they were in terms of finance. And today we call this financial infidelity. And we all know people who do it, but you just don't think of someone like the Lincolns and having that dynamic in their marriage.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Let's talk about a more contemporary example of a president and his money, and that is Donald Trump. Now, he's certainly not the first president born into wealth. FDR, JFK were also came from wealthy families. Mm-hmm. Trump's father was a successful real estate person in New York. What did you learn about his relationship to money in researching this book?
Yeah, I mean, Trump's an interesting one, right? And you see this with a lot of families that are what we would call dynastic. The focus on money is very, very different in the sense that they're willing to engage with very intricate estate and tax planning. Whether you agree with Donald Trump's approach, what I would tell you is he's willing to focus on getting the right advice. And there's a reason for this. When you're dealing with generational wealth, you have to think that each generation has a certain goal. So Fred Trump, Donald Trump's father, is generation one. Donald Trump is generation two. Donald Jr., Eric, Ivanka, Tiffany, and Barron are generation three, and their children are generation four. And so the goals of these families are to push the assets down generation after generation. And so from what we can see from Donald Trump's estate plans and from what we know about him tax-wise, he is willing to engage in very intricate estate planning techniques. The thing about Trump you have to keep in mind is he is very comfortable with risk. In fact, he enjoys pushing the envelope. I don't think that's a shock to you, right? So when you see him do these estate planning techniques, what you can't really see, but unless you had the gift tax return or some of the tax returns, is he's making very aggressive stances on things like valuations. And that's because he's trying to get assets down generations at the lowest value. And this is not uncommon with high net worth individuals and ultra high net worth families. So I would tell you that Donald Trump, like you, is a good example of someone who is doing generational wealth transfer, is hiring top tax and estate people. But what makes it unique with Trump is he's willing to push the envelope in order to get a better deal for himself.
Yeah, push the envelope is one way of euphemizing that, perhaps. Let's listen to a clip, another clip we have here. This is a former NBC marketing executive, John Miller, talking to Katie Turr on MSNBC last year about President Trump back when he was on The Apprentice, which ran for 15 seasons.
But the big thing was is that we had to make Donald Trump look like he was a big executive. And before that, he was largely popular in New York. He'd been bankrupt at least four times from various businesses, I think two more after the show went on the air. And so clearly we had to make something bigger than it was. As I sort of say in promotion, we're making mountains out of molehills every day.
So he wasn't a good business executive.
Well, if someone had been bankrupt one of his businesses four different times and then six in total, I'm not so sure.
Okay, so Trump is not only wealthy, but he has this element of celebrity going for him, which not too many other presidents had quite. I don't know if anyone had it to his degree in the modern media environment. Maybe Ronald Reagan, the actor. But did The Apprentice come up in your work on Trump?
It did a little because look, he brings up a good point, which is I think that when we think of someone as being wealthy, we don't understand that there are ups and downs to having wealth. And I think Trump rode a and has continued to ride a very big roller coaster. So you look at things like Truth Social, there have been moments where he has done incredibly well with that stock and moments that he has not done incredibly well with that stock. He's willing to ride it out. And so do I think at times that the perception of his wealth is larger than it is? Yes, of course. But I think it goes to something in the American psyche. I think Donald Trump represents what a lot of people think wealthy people are really about. And I think if you, when you work with wealthy individuals like I do, what you find is the ones who are often the wealthiest are incredibly boring with their money. They're not showy, it's very understated. And I think a good example of that are the
Stealth wealth,
presidents.
right? Is that's the phrase
Stealth
you
wealth, totally. Yes. Like if you actually ever look at like the FDR White House, people would didn't love being invited over to the White House when FDR was in office. Not because they didn't like FDR, but they didn't serve the best food. It just wasn't, they didn't spend to impress. They were old money and they were really old money. So I think the thing is, we as Americans have certain perceptions that we want to have about what money is supposed to be, and we're unwilling to really look at things that are a little more boring, right? I mean, you look at people, you look at presidents like, for instance, Jimmy Carter. When Jimmy Carter ran for office in 1976, he was incredibly wealthy. Between the Carter Farms, the warehouses, right? He had extensive assets, and yet he had managed to pitch himself to the American public as a peanut farmer, right? Completely not the truth there. And in fact, when he was running against Ford, Ford only had a couple hundred thousand dollars worth of assets. But again, when you think about it, presidents use their wealth to build perception. Another president that used wealth on perception is, and Barack Obama was someone who didn't come from money, struggled on the way up, and had accrued significant student loan debt. We only have two presidents that had significant student loan debt, Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. But what's interesting about Barack Obama is if you were to listen to his speeches in 2012, he sort of implied he was still dealing with debt. But when you look at his book, Dreams of My Father, which came out in the mid-90s, when he ran for Senate, they reissued that book in 2005. And between 2005 and 2015, from when he left the last returns we had from him, he made over $16 million from that book. And so again, I tell people, you know, there's always money and then there's perceptions. And I think Donald Trump is a very good example of someone who plays with perceptions because he's what the American public believes is what you're supposed to look like when you're incredibly wealthy. I can tell you I'm in a lot of wealthy people's houses. There's not a lot of gold like there is at places like Mar-a-Lago.
There's this pervasive notion out there, I think, that rich people who go into politics don't need the money, therefore they are better choices. So, you know, we have this governor in Illinois, Bruce Rauner, who is a private equity guy. Then we have J.B. Pritzker, who's an heir to the Hyatt Hotel fortune. Obviously, Donald Trump, Elon Musk. In your experience, as somebody who works with wealthy people, do they not care about making more money? They're just content with what they have and just going to coast on that? Or how do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're asking me a little bit about the businessman politician question, right? And the thing is, everybody wants to make money. It's human nature. It's part of their drive. You don't get to that level of politics or business unless you are incredibly ambitious. But I always think about the fact that one of the best businessmen who became president was Warren G. Harding. Harding bought a newspaper when he was about 20 years old for $300 and turned it into a huge newspaper that had a big impact on politics in the turn of the century and through the 20s. And yet he was fabulous at running the newspaper. His employees, who he let become owners, buy in, loved him. He was not a great president. So what I would tell you is this. It's really dependent upon the person. There's no rhyme or reason. I will tell you that some of the businessmen presidents, like a Warren G. Harding, great businessman, not a great president. Another one who was very good at business, Herbert Hoover, not a great president. And so I would say that the ones that do the best are the ones that have more experience in the legislature or have experience working their way up in politics before they take that big job. And that was the mistake I think both Harding and Hoover made in terms of becoming president. They never had any other job in politics but those jobs.
I love that answer because, you know, I've covered politics for 20 years now, and it's the one profession in American life where people think not having relevant experience is a selling point for the job. So
it's funny that that's it. Just to be accurate, Hoover was Secretary of Commerce under Coolidge, but he didn't work his way up through politics.
Yeah, fascinating. Megan Gorman is the author of All the President's Money, How the Men Who Governed America Governed Their Money. She's also the founding partner of Checkers Financial Management. Megan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today on The 21st Show.
Excellent. Thanks for having me on.
That is all the time we have for our show today. Coming up tomorrow on The 21st Show, it's our week in review. We'll talk about what's been happening in different parts of the state, as well as in state and national politics, with our Washington correspondent, Linda Kenyon. The 21st Show is produced by Anna Casey, Christine Hatfield, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Kulsum Khan. Technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Let us know what you thought about our show by emailing talk@21stshow.org. You can also find that address and every other way to contact us on our website, 21stshow.org. While you're there, you can find links to our podcast or just look us up on Apple or Spotify or YouTube, wherever you listen. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.